41st Psalm, commencing at the first verse. Lord, I cry unto thee, make haste unto me. Give ear unto my voice when I cry unto thee. Let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. Set a watch, O Lord, before my mouth. Keep the door of my lips. Incline not mine heart to any evil thing, to practice wicked works with men that work iniquity, and let me not eat of their dainties. And we're reading from the 8th of Revelation, in the 4th verse. And the smoke of the incense, which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. Let's pray. If we have to spend this afternoon, dear friends, we continue with the third piece of furniture in the holy of the tabernacle. Thus far we have already considered the golden candlestick and the table of the showbread. We would remind you in passing that the tabernacle itself represented three states or conditions of grace. The first of these is justification, the second is sanctification, and the third is glorification. We call them states of grace because they are of grace. They're not of us, since if it were so, some might have there whereof to boast. But on the other hand, I feel sure there most of us wouldn't have anything that would entitle us to a place in the grace of God. So we say then, dear friends, that we just want to remind you for the moment that the three places, the court, the holy, and the most holy of the tabernacle, correspond to these three states of grace, that is justification, sanctification, and glorification. But we would also extend that, dear friends, because we believe that these three places in the tabernacle might also represent the three cardinal graces, the first of which is faith, the second of which is hope, and the last of which is love. And our reason for suggesting this is because if you have justification, it'll only be because of faith. So the court quite naturally would correspond to a state or condition of faith. Sanctification would represent the outworking of that faith in works. And the work of faith is hope. Because he that hath this hope purifieth himself. There is the work of faith manifested in hope. The last, the most holy, which represents glorification, also represents love, because there you have entered into the presence of him who is love, and you will have been perfected in your nature, so that you in your divine nature will have a love like unto God. Thus by faith, through hope, you attain to that which will always remain when both faith and sanctification have given way to the realization in the glory of the Most Holy. Now, on that account, we have suggested that most of the furnishings in the Holy have to do with our hope, not so much with our faith, but there could be no hope without faith, since faith is the substance of the things that you hope for, and it's the conviction that you have of things which are not seen. When you've exercised faith in the court of the tabernacle, you could not see what you now can see, so that you have already realized in a measure what faith accepted. But while you have realized some, you have not realized all, because what we see now is only in part. There is that which is perfect which still remains. And when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. So even the state and condition of hope in which you now find yourself will pass away in the realization or the fruition of your hopes, when this mortal shall have put on immortality. You remember then that we also suggested that the fact that the table of the showbread was made of shittim wood, it wasn't made of gold, it was made of shittim wood but overlaid with gold. So was the Ark of the Covenant. It was made of shittim wood. It wasn't made of gold, but it was overlaid with gold. And undoubtedly the thought here is that the shittim wood, which belonged to an evergreen tree, corresponds to the mortal, not necessarily the dying or the dead, but to the mortal which is swallowed up of immortality and puts on immortality. And when you go beyond the veil, the mortal is swallowed up of immortality because it has put on immortality. That is the state and condition beyond the veil. But this side of the veil, the fact that the table was made of shittim wood and overlaid with gold bespeaks the hope of glorification. You remember that when the priest was consecrated, and this you'll find in the 8th chapter of Leviticus, that they were placed into the hands of the priests beside the offering three pieces of unleavened bread. One was merely unleavened. The other was dipped in oil. The last was a wafer. And Brother Russell suggests that these three represent justification, sanctification, and the hope of glorification. Notice, he didn't say glorification, but he said the hope of glorification. And so, when you were consecrated, you didn't receive your glorification. Yes, you got your justification. You got your sanctification. And the hope of glorification. Now, this hope which we have is an anchor which holds fast to that which is beyond the veil, where Christ is already gone, you see. So then, we see, dear friends, how the things in the holy would correspond to that second cardinal grace of the Spirit, which is hope. Now abideth faith for the church, hope for the church, and love. That commences here, but the fullness and the glory of it is only realized after we've made our calling and our election sure. Now you see, dear friends, in the hope of the church's glorification, she holds forth the word of life. Now the word of life which she holds forth is not the word of life that she holds forth to the world, because this is the word of truth as ministered unto those who are in the holy of the tabernacle. This is that service that you and I render to one another as brethren in the household of faith. This has nothing directly to do with any other witness, but it has to do with us so long as we dwell within the holy of the tabernacle. This same thought was suggested by the coverings which were over the table as it moved through the camp. You remember, there was a cloth of red, and there was a cloth of scarlet. It wasn't so with the candlestick. It wasn't so with the golden altar. It wasn't so with the brazen altar. It wasn't so with the Ark of the Covenant. This is the only one, the table of the showbread, which had these two coverings underneath the sealskin. And since the table bespeaks of communion with God and communion with our brethren who are within the holy, you see the cloth of scarlet and the cloth of blue indicate a faithfulness unto death. That is, in laying down our lives for the brethren. That's the thought suggested. That's not the thought that the world will get, because all the world can see is the sealskin covering on the outside, a rough, unsightly skin. And how rough, and how unsightly. Sometimes the roughness on the unsightliness of the sealskin bothers even the truth friends. You understand? But really, we shouldn't see the sealskin, because we're dwelling in the holy of the tabernacle. We should know no man according to the flesh, though we knew Christ as such. We should know them only in the Spirit. Now you'll notice then, dear friends, that the incense altar was made the same as the table, of shittim wood, overlaid with gold. Here again we see that which bespeaks the hope of the glory that is to be ours. There are many ways in which this is set forth in the tabernacle of old, but of course we shouldn't have time to deal with that in one short hour. And we're not going to inflict it upon you by continuing it endlessly. So we're going to deal with the incense altar today, and we intend to finish the subject today. Now, the incense altar, we said, was made of shittim wood, overlaid with gold. It stood in the holy of the tabernacle, but you know, there's been so much discussion concerning that altar of incense as to where it stood, as to where it was placed. And yet there should be no difficulty. Certainly the Old Testament scriptures are quite clear on it, and the New Testament scriptures seem to suffer by a mistranslation, or at most, if such there be, by what Brother Russell called a lapsus linguae, which means, in common ordinary language, a slip of the tongue on the part of the Apostle Paul. We don't think that the trouble was with Paul. We think it was undoubtedly with the recorders and the translators. Because in our common version, it indicates that this incense altar stood in the most holy of the tabernacle. Oh, you remind me, it doesn't say incense altar. Quite true, it does not say incense altar. It says censer. But, dear friends, the translators of the Authorized Version took too much liberty unto themselves when they rendered the word censer. All translations, Rotherham, Weymouth, Moffat, the Revised Version, the Standard Revised, Montgomery, every one of them, including the Diaglot, speak of it as the incense altar. Now, since we understand that in the text in Hebrews 9, 2, and 3, reference is not to a censer, because then that would have been a golden censer. And there's not a word indicated in the scriptures that there was such a thing as a golden censer. The censers were made of copper. If there was a golden censer, it certainly isn't specifically mentioned in the scriptures. And this would be the only place where a reference would be made to it. So we believe it was the golden incense altar. But you see, that would still leave unresolved the fact that Paul seems to say that this altar was in the most holy with the Ark of the Covenant. This, of course, is not so. And I think the trouble lies in the fact that the translators again have missed the point in rendering it as they have. We do know that the emphatic diaglot corrects this mistranslation, and Professor Wilson, in a footnote to Hebrews 9, 2, and 3, says that the Vatican manuscript seems to reconcile the Mosaic account with the New Testament. In other words, in the Old Testament, it is definitely established in Leviticus 4 and 7 and 18. It specifically tells us that this altar was in the tabernacle of the congregation, not in the most holy, but in the tabernacle of the congregation. Well, we find then, dear friends, that while the incense altar was placed in the holy of the tabernacle, it belonged, as it were, to the most holy. That seems strange language, doesn't it? Actually, its place was in the holy, but it belonged to the most holy. Now, the reason we suggest that is because in the book of Kings, in the first book of Kings, in the 6th chapter, and in the 21st and 22nd verses, it makes mention of those things in the temple which corresponded to the things in the tabernacle. And it says, so Solomon overlaid the house within with pure gold, and he made a partition by the chains of gold before the oracle, and he overlaid it with gold. And the whole house he overlaid with gold until he had finished all the house. Also the whole altar that, it says, was by the oracle. But in the Standard Revised Version and in the Hebrew text, it says, the whole altar that belonged to the oracle. Now, what is the oracle? And within the oracle, he made two cherubims of olive tree, each 10 cubits high, and so forth and so on. So you can see the oracle is identified with the Most Holy in the Ark of the Covenant, and this would seem to belong to it. So that undoubtedly what the Apostle Paul was saying, he was making mention of this incense altar, that it belonged to the Most Holy, but not that it was in the Most Holy. And the reason for that may become apparent as we go along with the text. This we find only by going back to the original manuscripts and to the language, the Hebrew text, And sometimes, of course, we're able to unearth there the errors that were made. And you remember that Wilson in his emphatic diaglot suggests that there were over 20,000 errors in the Authorized Version. Some of them are not serious. Some are matters of punctuation, some of spelling, some in taking a name over from the Old Testament to the New. For instance, you'll find N-O-E in the New Testament for N-O-A-H in the Old Testament. Well, they might just as well have translated them both alike, made them Noah in both instances, because it's the same person. But you see, they weren't consistent. In one place they speak of that since Jesus did not bring them into the promised land, well, there they've taken the Greek equivalent of Joshua. They translated Joshua to the Greek Jesus. Really, the text should read, since Joshua didn't bring them into the promised land. You understand? So we're not going to be too critical. Probably we would have done very, very much worse if we ourselves had been one of those translators and indoctrinated in the doctrines and the theories and the tenets of the Episcopal Church. We probably done far worse. I think God overruled it purposely so that this cleansing, as it were, of his word of truth might be left almost to the very end. That faith being exercised by the church all throughout the age, when the end of the age came, there would be additional trials by virtue of the fact that these mistranslations would be unearthed. Now you take your word hell, Sheol, Hades, Gehenna, Tartarus. They've translated all of these hell. And in fact, Sheol has been translated hell, grave, and pit. And yet you know they don't always mean the same thing. So we say then, dear friends, so much for the position of the altar of incense. It had its place in the holy of the tabernacle before the veil. And that, of course, you'll find in Leviticus in the 4th chapter, and in the 7th verse, and again in the 18th. And just so that you will have it before you, because you may not even look it up when you get home, and we'll read it to you here now. And the priest shall put some of the blood upon the horns of the altar of sweet incense before the Lord, which is in the tabernacle of the congregation. And then in the 18th verse, and he shall put some of the blood upon the horns of the altar, which is before the Lord, that is in the tabernacle of the congregation. In both of those instances, it specifically puts it in the holy of the tabernacle. That's exactly where it should be. But it's the closest tie between that incense altar and the Ark of the Covenant. You'll find that the incense altar stood closer to the veil than either the candlestick or the table of the showbread. Well, we would remind you, dear friends, that this altar was to be used in connection with the atonement for the children of Israel. Once every year, the high priest would put the blood of atonements on the horns of this altar. In Exodus, the 30th chapter, where it describes this altar, and thou shalt make an altar to burn incense upon, of shittim wood shalt thou make it. And a cubit shall be the length thereof, and a cubit the breadth thereof, fourscore shall it be. The 2 cubits shall be the height thereof, the horn thereof shall be of the same. And thou shalt overlay it with pure gold, the top thereof, and the sides thereof, round about the horns thereof, and thou shalt make unto it a crown of gold round about, both the table of the showbread and the incense altar had a crown of gold. There is reflected the hope for the crown of life, the crown of immortality, the glorification, the divine nature. This side of the veil, it represents that hope. Beyond the veil, it represents the realization. But we have a hope. That is this hope of which the apostle speaks, which is as an anchor to the soul, holding fast to that which is beyond the veil. So you see the connection between the two. The only thing that separates them is the veil. And then it says, And thou shalt put it before the veil, that is by the ark of the testimony, before the mercy seat, that is over the testimony where I will meet with thee. And Aaron shall burn thereon sweet incense every morning when he dresseth the lamps, and he shall burn incense upon it. And when Aaron lighteth the lamps at even, he shall burn incense upon it, a perpetual incense before the Lord throughout your generations. So there you see one purpose was to burn the incense upon it. But you will also note that there is something else reflected in this account. And we find this in the 10th verse. And Aaron shall make an atonement upon the horns of it once in a year with the blood of the sin offering of atonements. Plural. Once in a year shall he make atonement upon it throughout your generations. It is most holy unto the Lord. Here is something that is most holy unto the Lord in the holy of the tabernacle. You see, the link between the two is already established. But, dear friends, let's not be mistaken. That was not the only blood that was put upon the horns of the incense altar. But once in a year, the blood of atonements, in other words, not merely blood of atonement. Any blood could be the blood of atonement that was shed throughout the year. There were atonements made for the priests. There were atonements made for the common people. There were atonements for the princes, for the rulers. They made at various times. They were atonements, surely, but they were not the atonement. So the blood of the atonement of atonements, that was placed upon the altar once in a year, and it was in reference to this that the Apostle Paul made mention of it. There had to be a reconciliation of the Most Holy by the blood being sprinkled on and before the mercy seat, of the Holy by the blood being put upon the horns of the incense altar, and of the court by the blood being sprinkled and placed at the base of the altar of burnt offering in the court. And thus those three places, those three states were reconciled by virtue of the blood of the atonement. Now, of course, not all blood was carried into the Most Holy. But the bodies of such beasts as whose blood was carried into the Most Holy to make atonement for sin, they were burned with fire outside the camp. But you see, dear friends, the burnt offering which might be for a priest, the anointed priest might sin after the manner of the people and do somewhat against the commandments of the Lord. If that were the case, then it would require a bullock to be sacrificed for him. A bullock had to be sacrificed for the priest. But you see, dear friends, its blood was taken into the holy of the tabernacle. So likewise, for the whole congregation, not a goat, but a bullock again. But if it happened to be for one of the common people, then the blood wasn't even brought into the holy, but it was used over the altar that was in the court. So you see that the altar did have other blood placed upon it. But we're putting the emphasis upon the fact that the blood of atonements was placed on the horns of the incense altar, and Aaron could not go into the Most Holy on the Day of Atonement unless that had been accomplished. And since he could not have blood to put on the horns of the altar unless an animal was slain, you see how it is that the Apostle Paul says it is appointed unto men once to die, and after that, the judgment. He doesn't refer to mere men. He refers to the priesthood. One thing to die, and then to pass the judgment. But note, dear friends, that when Aaron died, he died in that bullock. That's where the blood was supplied. Now do you see why it is that in the third verse of the 16th chapter, God says through Moses, don't let Aaron come unto me at all times. Come into my presence, into the Most Holy. But if he comes, let him come with a sin offering. What's implied? Well, he couldn't go into the Most Holy unless he had the blood of the sacrifice that was slain. And then he couldn't proceed with that blood into the Most Holy until first he had offered incense at the golden altar. It was just as important that the incense rise from the altar, filling the holy and permeating the veil and going beyond, covering the mercy seat, preparing the way for the priest. No atonement could have been accomplished unless the incense from the golden altar had arisen before God. Now note then, dear friends, if that be true, what does it mean? It means in the first instance that the incense had to do with the testimony concerning Jesus' own life. And if Jesus had fallen short in his own life, there could have been no atonement for anyone. There would today be no ones that might be called a royal priesthood, even in an elect sense. So you see, dear friends, why it is that the scriptures specifically say that he die not. Now there were two things that were necessary then. First, the consecration unto death, represented by the death of the animal. And the second thing, a faithfulness unto death in the priest carrying out the ritual which would bring in atonement for the people. Now there you see, dear friends, the importance of that incense altar. And yet I say that the people never saw this altar. It was always hidden from their view. It was covered with a cloth of blue, and then over the top of it was the sealskin. So the church, this side of the veil, including Jesus, are represented in the incense altar. From this incense altar arises the sweet incense as a sweet savor unto God. Does the world see it? No, the world doesn't see it. But those who are with us in the holy should see it. And if they don't see it, they're either not in the holy, or they have gone outside the holy. And that's not a thought that we suggest. You'll find it in tabernacle shadows. Now, dear friends, you'll note then that the incense altar representing the church this side the veil as it passes through the world, through the camp of Israel in the type, could not be seen, only the sealskin. So the cloth of blue which covered the altar could not be seen. So your faith and my faith, your faithfulness and my faithfulness before God is not discerned by the world. All that they can see, not the gold, not the shittim wood, not the cloth of blue, but the sealskin, which represents your flesh and my flesh. But not your flesh and my flesh in the ordinary sense of the word, but the flesh of Jesus. And that's where, dear friends, we want to take a very important lesson. Because your flesh is not your flesh. For me to live, says the Apostle Paul, is for Christ to live. So that he says that he was dying daily. Why? So that the life of Jesus might be manifested in his mortal flesh. So once you have become identified with Jesus, it's no longer your flesh. You are the body of Christ still in the flesh. And therefore, you will suffer what is left behind of the afflictions of Christ for the body's sake, which is the church. That's why you suffer afflictions, for the body's sake, which is the church. That's what Paul did. That's what you and I must likewise do. So you see then, dear friends, the world cannot see any sweet incense arising to God from the golden altar. All that they can see is your flesh. But they don't discern it as the flesh of Christ any more than they did in Jesus' day. Who hath believed our report? To whom hath the arm of the Lord been revealed? There was Jesus right in their midst. Did they recognize him? Of course they didn't. Why? Because of the seal skin covering. What a beautiful picture of the church, that she is identified with Jesus, that for her to live is for Jesus to live, and for her to die is for Jesus to die. No wonder the Apostle Paul puts it, "Oh, that I might know him in the power of his resurrection, the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death, if by any means I might attain unto the resurrection of the dead." So you see, dear friends, then, in this regard, there is the thought of the church's identification with Jesus now here in our fleshly life. It is Jesus that is dying daily as the church dies. That was what could the Apostle Paul have meant otherwise? Surely the no creature doesn't die. But he says, "I die daily." What is it that dies daily? Certainly not the new creature, but is that humanity that is identified with Jesus, even as Jesus for 3.5 years poured out his soul unto death. Now you see, dear friends, why it is that the world cannot appreciate your position before God and my position before God. They can't see the gold. They can't see the cloth of blue. They can't see the incense. They can only see the flesh, but they cannot discern what they see. People see, but do not know what they see. So we find then, dear friends, the incense altar is a beautiful picture of the church. Perhaps initially we should say that the incense altar would represent Christ Jesus and Jesus alone, because it is upon this altar that the church itself is represented as a sacrifice. Now, no blood or bloody sacrifice was ever offered on the incense altar. The only thing that was ever put upon the altar that had the taste of flesh was the life, which was the blood, because the blood, or in the blood, is the life. It showed how the life was carried out of one condition into another condition. You see? So, of course, it shows forth a giving away of this human life to the spirit-begotten life, to the spirit-born life eventually. And when we have attained in faithfulness to the spirit-born life, then and only then will the merit that we need, and which has been loaned to us or mortgaged to us, be released for the blessing of the world of mankind. Now then, you notice, dear friends, that the incense which was offered on this altar might also, in the primary sense, be looked upon as Jesus in his perfect humanity. Because when we consider the perfect man Jesus as he came in contact with the trials of life, the fires that tried him, what did he yield? A sweet obedience to the will of God. That certainly was a sweet savor. And there we have a beautiful picture of Jesus offering the incense at the golden altar. Now, in the very general picture, Brother Russell suggests that we too offer incense at the golden altar. But that is a picture bearing no direct relationship to any of the rituals in the type. But it is a general picture, because in the type, only the high priest offered the incense at the golden altar. But in a general picture, you and I as priests in our approach to God must likewise offer incense at the golden altar. But with you and with me, there is no perfect humanity. There's nothing like that that can come in contact with the trials of life and yield a sweet obedience. Well, when a little trial comes your way, how do you act? Or let me say, how do you react? Well, if you examine yourselves and look inwardly, you'll probably find, as we're all prone to find, that in my flesh there dwelleth no good thing. Evil is ever present. I know what I'd want to do, but the Apostle Paul says, how to do it, I know not. And if Paul said that, are we any better than Paul? Can we say any more than he said? Of course not. He was not one whit behind the chiefest of the apostles. And what he bound in earth and loosed in earth, we can rest assured, was bound and loosed in heaven. Now the incense that was used by the priest of old had four ingredients. And we like it very, very much, because we see that the incense has a double significance. It can represent the prayers of the saints. Now from the 141st Psalm in the second verse, it says, "Let my prayers arise like incense." Now there, the prayer is referred to as incense itself. But in Revelation, it also speaks of the sweet odors or the sweet incense that arose from the censer with the prayers of the saints. So you see that incense can be used in two different connections. Now we're going to use it as arising with the prayers of the saints. Not that the other thought isn't correct. It is. They're both correct. But for the time being, we want to lead you into a little thought here by the wayside. Come over and rest for a while. So, the four ingredients are given to us in Exodus, the 30th chapter, commencing at the 34th verse, and it says, "And the Lord said unto Moses, Take unto thee sweet spices, stacte, onica, galbanum, these sweet spices with pure frankincense, of each shall there be like weight." Now notice, stacte, onica, galbanum, three spices, and there shall be one weight, one weigh just as much as the other. There'll be no more of one than another. They'll just be equal in weight. It's important that we get this. And then it says, with pure frankincense. Now we've oftentimes wondered what these four ingredients might represent. Of course, Brother Russell has suggested that the frankincense represents praise. And he also has suggested, though not quite so directly, as to what the stacte, the onica, and the galbanum represented. We're going to suggest, as Brother Russell says, that stacte represents faith, the onica represents love, the galbanum represents obedience, and the frankincense represents praise. Now here's where some little points of interest come in. The stacte that is referred to here is in the Hebrew nataf, and it refers to a pearl or a tear. And to me, dear friends, that is a beautiful picture of one of the ingredients that must arise with your prayers. You can't just pray to God in just a few words and tell him all you want and all that you'd like and so forth and so on. The faith he referred to is a faith that is faith through tears and through bitter trials. Undoubtedly, stacte is the Greek word that the Septuagint translators used in translating the Hebrew word nataf. And we believe that it was the stacte myrrh. And myrrh, you know, is only a step from Mary. And Mary and myrrh both mean bitter. So there is a suggestion here of bitter tears. And he who would exercise this faith must exercise it oft times through bitter cryings and tears. There's only one that is able to save you in that which you fear. There was only one that was able to save him who cried and sweated drops of blood to the only one that was able to save him and who was heard because of his faithfulness. So, dear friends, it's easy enough for you to have faith when you don't need it. But when the trial comes, when some disappointment comes, when somebody does this or does that and you don't understand and you don't comprehend and you throw yourself right into the midst of all the works, it isn't that, dear friends. If you can just leave it all to God, through crimes and tears, through misunderstandings and misapprehensions, still to have faith in the unseen hand of God, that all of these things are working together for your good. Then I say, dear friends, if you've got a faith like that, that goes up with your prayers. And that makes it possible for your prayer to have access with God, because it cannot have access unless it arises with a faith that will trust God even where it cannot trace. Oh, dear friends, the meaning in these ingredients of the incense is so deep that I doubt very much that any of us are able to comprehend it. And that includes me, lest anyone should think that I'm a little wiser. I'm not. It's only our love for these things of God that permits us to sometimes see some of these glories that we hadn't seen before. But there's no honor due us. It's the grace of God and the reward of an earnest seeking faith. And you can have the same thing, and I know you have it. So you see, dear friends, the stacte myrrh, or the first ingredient, would represent a faith not untried, but a faith that is tried. There's a big difference. I've seen people, when other people have gone through trials and experiences, they say, well, remember, dear brother and sister, all things work together for good to those that love the Lord. But the time came when it was just in the reverse order, and the trial and the difficulty came their way. Then they forgot all about it, and they were inclined to doubt and wondered whether God was still dealing with them. Dear friends, you see, that is the spirit of a doubter. And doubt cannot arise with the prayer of a saint. It must be this faith. And what a beautiful thought. Pearls of tears. A sweet incense to God. One of the ingredients. Then came the onycha, dear friends. And the onycha came from the operculum. Now let me explain that. That's a part of a shellfish. And it was used, it was ground into powder and made a part of the sweet incense. And that which yielded the fragrance was the burning of what remained of the flesh of the animal. What a beautiful picture this is of the incense that must arise with the prayers of the saints. Whatever there is left of the flesh must be sacrificed in love for our brethren. I say our brethren because, dear friends, this has relationship to the Holy of the Tabernacle. While Jesus died for the church, it was effective for the whole world. And so you and I are baptized for all of the dead. The dead world, as it were, so that we might bless all. But we have a ministry now. And this is the ministry, not of reconciliation such as we have toward the world, but a ministry to those who are reconciled to God. And for these, as we would for Jesus, we must be willing to lay down our lives. So here, the operculum of a shellfish, and what yields the fragrance is that which is consumed by the heat. You notice, dear friends, that it is heat that is applied that causes them to yield. Here we see something that speaks of a love not untried, but a love that is put to the test. Could you still trust, though everybody said nay? Have you ever had friends whom you loved and trusted? And as you heard a story from one or two, suddenly you begin to doubt. What is it? We've learned long since, dear friends, never to seek again to vindicate ourselves. We leave our vindication to God. There is one who judges, and he judges righteously. So if you can leave all of this vindication to God, who is righteous and never errs in his judgment, then you too will have the peace. It may mean tears. It means sometimes, dear friends, separations from those whom you love dearly. It may mean a great deal more than this, but whatever it means, it too is one of the ingredients that goes to make up this sweet incense, love. You see, faith, love, but not love untried. A love which in the face of everything that is contrary to it and against it, still trusts and believes. What a love. The third of these ingredients was galbanum. We don't know too much about the galbanum, but Pliny and Virgil, they both say that the smoke which would arise from the burning of galbanum would drive away snakes. Now, we don't know how true that may be literally, but we do believe in it figuratively, spiritually. Obedience to God will drive away all of the serpents of Satan. Many of these ingredients could be used in a medicinal way, and that's the beauty of it, dear friends. When you take a firm stand in obedience to the Father's will, it may be like a medicine to some brother or sister who may be wavering, who may be uncertain, may be insecure. But your obedience to the will of God, not when it's easy to be obedient, but under trial, then, dear friends, you've got the third of the ingredients which go in to make up the sweet incense. That's what's necessary if you want your prayer to be answered. If your prayers arise with the sweet incense, then, dear friends, it'll be your faith under trial, your love under trial, your obedience under trial. You notice in every one of these instances, it was the fire, the heat, not actually fire, but heat. The fire was on the altar, but burning embers, called coals of fire, were brought in the censer and placed upon the golden altar. And then this incense was crumbled by the high priest's own hand. And as it fell upon the burning embers, the heat thereof caused them to yield this sweet savor. When you're under trial, when your faith is under trial, can you be sweet? When your love is called into question, can you still be sweet? Can you pray for those who bear a false witness against you, knowing that your own heart is right? Can you do it? That's one of the ingredients. Obedience to the will of God, no matter what anyone else might say about it. You know, your obedience, God holds you accountable for what you understand of His will. He might let someone else go for the very thing that He won't let you go for. But that's none of your business. Follow thou me, is what the Lord said to Peter. When Peter asked concerning John, what about him? That's none of your business, Peter. And so Paul's a study to be quiet. You know, it's really a study. It's not a thing that comes natural. You've got to study to be quiet and to mind your own business. So, you see, we come to the last of the ingredients, which was the frankincense. And, of course, in the Hebrew, the thought, the name frankincense really has reference to the whiteness of this gum which exuded from the tree when an incision was made. Now notice, dear friends, here's the thought of taking a knife and making an incision into a tree, and what does it give? It yields this frankincense. But the Hebrew word has been transliterated. Not translated, but transliterated. In other words, the word has been taken as it appears in the Hebrew, and its exact equivalent has been given to us in our translations in English. which is very good because it says frank incense. What does that mean? Incense which is frank. And what's frank? Something that is open and just lets out. And so when the heat is applied to the frankincense, it's already been wounded once, the tree has. It's yielded the frankincense by incision. And now it's subject to the fire. So your tribe has been subject to the knife of the high priest once, and now it is subject to the heat. And in the heat, what does it yield? Well, dear friend, God does not want, he wasn't taking pleasure in burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin. What he wanted was obedience. He wanted a heart that was loyal to God, a heart that was faithful in its trust, loving and obedient. Take those Hebrew children of old. Our God will deliver us, but there's the little goat. If not, we'll not bow down and worship the image. Do you notice that, dear friends? If God didn't deliver them, they would not be disappointed. They'd know that God's will was in its ultimate the best. And they wouldn't give way, even if God should indicate that he wasn't going to spare them the fiery furnace. But, dear friends, when did the one like unto the Son of Man appear? Only after the heat had been raised to 7 times its normal temperature. And so, dear friends, sometimes you and I, in a matter of faith, we're not spared getting into hot places, nor does our deliverance come immediately. We're left subject to the heat and the trial until the time comes when God himself says it's enough. And then one like unto the Son of Man appears in the midst, and there isn't even the smell of fire on our clothes, which haven't even been singed or burned. So you see, dear friends, the priest's access to the Most Holy was contingent upon the incense preceding him there. And if your prayers are to be acceptable before God, the sweet incense must reach him first. And that sweet incense bespeaks your faith, your love, your obedience, and your praise. Now don't think that you can have a lot of faith and therefore not be too obedient. Or don't think for a moment that you can give a lot of praise and forget about faith and obedience. Oh no, these had to be equal in parts. Not one more, not one less. You can't make up one by having an abundance of another. And then God also said through Moses, as for the perfume which thou shalt make, ye shall not make to yourselves according to the composition thereof. It shall be unto thee holy for the Lord. Whosoever shall make like unto it, that to smell thereto shall even be cut off from his people. This, dear friends, is against the sin of hypocrisy. You know, you can put on the appearance. You can get something that smells just like it. You go to the store and you ask for something you want, and the man behind the counter says, well, we don't have that, but we've got something just as good. Well, the chances are it isn't just as good. It's a substitute. It's an imitation. And so here God says, let no one try to imitate faith, obedience, love, and praise. Let no one be a hypocrite. If he has faith, let it be true faith. Let it be sincere. If he has love, let it be true. Let it be sincere. If he's obedient, let him be obedient at all times, not only when it's convenient. And if he would render praise, let the praise come from his heart. Now, dear friends, I'm just going to tell you one story. And that is that the praise doesn't have to be prompted by you. You don't have to force praise out. You don't have to sing a hymn just to say the word. It's got to come from the heart, and it will come from the heart if God's Spirit prompts it. It'll make all the difference in the world. And that's the reason that the high priest with his own hands crumbled the incense over the flames of fire, and that caused the incense to yield. So we say, dear friends, as far as faith is concerned, praise must come because God is at the console of the organ.